reading sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Finn Show,
the smooth talk of the town.
Cool. We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and today's April 14th, 2008. And it was on this day in 1984, a fitting year, 1984, think of the book, that the Texas Board of Education began requiring that the public school textbooks describe evolution, that is the evolution of human beings, as theory rather than fact, which is interesting because you might as well describe gravity as theory rather than fact, and I'm serious about that. And, of course, the Texas school books are kind of like the California laws on automobile pollution. There's such a big percentage of the market goes to Texas that it means that anybody that makes school books anywhere in the country probably altered their books. In any case, let's get back to Barack Obama. So he's on the Charlie Rose Show, and they're discussing the fact that rural voters, poor voters, don't always vote their economic interests. That is, they may side with Republicans because of religion, because of any number of other issues. This is background to the controversy Obama's in the midst of, in part a little bit overblown by his critics who want to attack him, both the Clinton camp on the Democratic side and the whole of the Republican machine interested in taking him down a peg. Here is Charlie Rose and Barack Obama.
Which suggests that that has somehow become a touchstone in a way that there's...
Well, I'll tell you an example. There's a town that I spoke about in my speech, actually, in Illinois, and it's I think, representative of many towns in the Midwest. Galesburg, Illinois. They've got 36,000 people. They've lost 4,000 jobs right. in the last 2 years. 20% of their employment base collapses because companies move out to Mexico. So you sit down and you talk to union workers, 50, 55-year-old guys, who the best that's being offered to them is retraining to be nurses' assistants. Right. Right? These guys with beards and, you know, tough guys who are used to handling heavy machinery. They're not optimistic about the prospects for them to be able to attain the kinds of economic security that they had under the old system. So they've got insecurity in their economic life. They don't know where their health care is coming from. They don't know what's happening with their pension. What they do know is that they can go out with their friends and hunt and feel a sense of camaraderie, and there's a connection between hunting and them going out with their father to hunt, just as there's a connection maybe for their wives to go into church and go on with their grandmother to church.
Now, the reason this is a parallel to what Obama said recently was his shorter version that everyone's criticizing is he said people are bitter and so they don't trust the government to help them economically, so instead of voting economics where they don't think they're going to get help, they vote guns or they vote religion. And that's part of where he's in trouble. But basically, this was a polite way of saying it. When he said they can go out and hunt, it is true, but that means because I feel strong about hunting, if there's gun control legislation, I'll have to be against it. I think that's where he's going with this point. Let me let them keep going here.
And if we don't have plausible answers on the economic front, and we appear to be condescending towards those traditions that are giving their lives some stability, then... You know, they're going to opt for at least that party that seems to be speaking to the things that are giving, that still provide them something solid to stand on.
And some sense that they're not being looked down on.
Exactly.
Somebody does not think that they are contemptuous of them.
Which is an interesting way to put it, since the claim that's been made for about Obama is that he is being contemptuous of the poor. Hillary's making it, and the Republicans are making it, and their spokespeople like Sean Hannity, Britt Hume, all those folks are making the claim that Obama's looking down on people and that he's the elitist here. Now, what's interesting, we already described the fact that he's the poorest of the three. He's the least well-off of the three candidates by far. The Clintons made $100 million in the last 8 years, and George and McCain married into hundreds of millions of dollars. So what's really interesting is that Obama becomes the elitist here because he's got a good education, he's articulate, and can talk about a range of issues. We've really come a long way when the black candidate is the elitist. You know, if you think about that, in some ways it's really a compliment. But, of course, both Hillary and the Republicans are doing what they can to take him down a peg. So it's going to be interesting. We still got a week and one day until we get to the next primary. The Pennsylvania primary has been weeks and weeks getting here. Don't you wish Michigan and Florida had held off and were kind of doing their primaries in this gap we've got right now? But no, they've had to create problems. Anyway, the other thing worth pointing out is that, you know, anytime you step on a landmine, you get trouble. So Obama's in trouble with this. He got in trouble with the Jeremiah Wright thing. Hillary got in trouble when she made up the story about going into Bosnia under fire. And these things only get off the radar screen, out of the news cycle, when another one comes up, it seems. Now, there's no substantive discussion to speak of policy issues or how good these people would be as managers or executives. And recently, Bill Clinton jumped back into the Bosnia thing by saying, well, we don't know what happened to Hillary there. She had some kind of a, he didn't say brain fart, but he might as well have. Beyond that, well, of course, and then let's go to McCain. McCain had his gaffe in multiple gaffes over the last couple of weeks, but mostly about not knowing that who the Shia and the Sunnis were and who Al-Qaeda was with in Iraq, which is, you'd think would be a big issue, but that blew over very quickly for him. The media is actually quite kind to McCain. I love these friends of mine who are conservatives that argue that the liberal media are helping Obama or helping Clinton. Pay attention to what's going on out there. Nobody's being helped more by the media than McCain. Now, it's true he's under less attack than Clinton and Obama because they're going head-to-head, but it's just really interesting how that's playing out. In any case, you know, that's really all I need to say about all of that. I think what we'll do is move on and let go of this election stuff. So let me, you know, I want to talk about General Petraeus and the testimony and the Iraq, really not less about General Petraeus and more about the Iraq situation. But, you know, we do that almost every week. So let me move on to a few other issues. The first is that you may know that the Secretary of HUD, Housing and Urban Development, Alfonso Jackson, is stepping down at the end of the month. Of course, he's caught up in this scandal, and he's accused of favoritism. He's being investigated, and he's pretty heavy-handed about some things. But there's another side to it, and that is this guy has a massive ego. The quote that killed me that was in the Washington Post this weekend, they did a long article about the fact that as the head of Housing and Urban Development, he basically neglected the housing crisis for a long time. He didn't see it coming, and when it was coming and others saw it, he poo-pooed it and said, no, this is a minor correction, that things will be fine. Of course, he doesn't have that much expertise. His main claim to the position was that he's been a friend of Bush's for many years and a neighbor. But Alfonso Jackson made this statement a while back, which I thought was hilarious. When Congress calls up and asks us, we'll give them advice. You have 534 massive egos up there, so unless they ask you, you don't volunteer anything. Well, I think I've already explained this on my show, but Alfonso Jackson is the guy who commissioned four oil paintings on an emergency funding basis, an emergency bid, which means I guess you don't have to get competitive bids. Spent $100,000 to have four oil paintings done of the him and the three previous heads of HUD to hang in an exhibit. And he's also the guy that had a photographic exhibit put up in a big atrium area at HUD. If I may have the facts wrong because I don't have them in front of me, and I reported on this a few weeks ago, but basically there were, I don't know, there were about 20 photographs. The smallest, I think, was 2 feet by 3 feet. Every one of the photographs included Alfonso HUD. So it was photographs of him with Bush. There were seven photographs of him with Bush or him with Bush and other people. And then there was him with governors, him with whoever. It was just one big admiration society for himself. And then he goes and says that Congress has massive egos. I just think that's hilarious. Where do you find the guts to do this kind of stuff? Where do you find the guts? If you're a congressperson, I don't see how you have the guts to have a building named after you while you're still in office or even still alive, or a road or a bridge. And yet these guys get the funding and they seek out this kind of adulation. I just don't get it, where people get these egos. Oh, anyway, that's the HUD chief who will be gone by the end of the month. There's a little bit going on in the world that's worth talking about before we get to Iraq. And the first one is in Zimbabwe. Now, this may seem a little bit esoteric, but if you're unfamiliar with this, it's worth knowing about these issues. So there was an election in Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe has been in power there for, well, since he was the hero of the revolution in the 80s. And he's 84 years old now. And inflation is running well over 100,000% a year, meaning it's out of control. Now, Mugabe brought this on himself in an effort to be popular with the rural poor. He drove white homeowners, white farm owners, off their farms. They were the backbone of the agricultural industry, which was the backbone of the economy. So he wrecked the economy. Didn't think this through. Short-term political gain, that is, get people to side with you because you're being tough on whitey. He wrecked his own economy. So that's the main reason people voted against him. They still think he's a hero. They've overlooked much of his brutality and much of his ignorance in recent years until this happened, and their pocketbooks are hurting. So Mugabe, they hold an election, and it looks like he lost, but they haven't announced the results yet. We're going on 2 weeks since the election happened. They announced the results of the congressional election they had within 48 hours of when it happened. But it's now been more than 10 days, and the election commission has not yet announced. And here's what happens. If any candidate gets 50%, like if the opposition candidate got 50%, he's automatically in and Mugabe will be out. If the opposition candidate gets less than 50%, there will be a runoff, and the second place finisher is Mugabe. So the fear is that if they agree to a runoff, and you know, the claim that they didn't get 50%, what could happen is Mugabe and his army and henchmen could get tough, intimidate people, keep them away from the polls, and somehow steal the second election. He would be overwhelmingly defeated, is the belief, if they hold an election. It's just not clear if they're going to hold an election. So what happened is that the election commission has stalled and stalled and stalled, and now they've said that there has to be a recount. So they're in the middle of a recount. People are afraid that they're going to steal the election. They can't just give it to Mugabe. But they could have make the results come out so that the opposition party doesn't get 50%, and then they get to fight another day at this runoff election. So it's unclear what's going to happen there, but this is bad news. And it's stories like this, you know, international stories, that they're out there, they're in the news, but we tend not to pay much attention in this country. Meanwhile, we're worried about whether or not Barack Obama can break 50 in his bowling score and what that means for his ability to serve as president. This is more international policy meets domestic politics. But basically, the House of Representatives delayed considering a trade agreement with Colombia. Now, in general, I'm in favor of free trade, and in general, I'm in favor of this agreement, despite the fact Democrats are opposing it. Now, part of going after the Democratic constituencies is that Democrats have to disown free trade and reasonable policies on trade because they want to hold on to Democratic voters. I think that's a mistake, but I understand why it's done, in the same way that I understand why Republicans in general hold on to immigration policies that shoot them in the foot with the rest of the electorate, and it doesn't make good common sense. You can't send 12 million people back, but they're holding on to those kinds of views because that's how you get reelected among the Republican base. But what happened with the situation in Colombia is interesting because Bush was warned by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats, don't send this bill up. We will pass it for you gladly on fast-track basis if you will meet my demands to increase the stimulus package. Here's what I want, and some good old-fashioned horse trading. Bush didn't agree to do it, and he thought he could send it up and force the Democrats' hand because there's a rule in the House, current House rules say you must consider these trade agreements under fast-track legislation within the first 90 days. So he thought he could force, or 60 days, he thought he could force their hands. The House just got together, and the Democrats on a party-line vote changed the rule and said, we don't have to take it up in 60 days. We could take it, we give ourselves an indefinite amount of time. So basically, Pelosi has gone to Bush and said, I warned you not to send it up, and I'm telling you we're not going to consider it while you're still in office, meaning we don't want to touch this hot potato before the election. It doesn't serve us, and we're not willing to let you set trade policy at this point. You're a lame duck. So Pelosi's standing up a little bit to Bush, but we'll see where that standoff takes us. And then finally, and this is finally before we get to the Iraq news, and maybe this is Iraq news. It came out last week, and this information got dumped on a Friday, as it often is when it's bad news. It came up that President Bush was aware that his top national security advisors, discussed harsh interrogation tactics on to be used on detainees. And they basically, at the highest levels of the White House and White House staff, they signed off on torture. Basically, the president and by implication, his staff has admitted that he and his staff oversaw torture. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that Bush, being a black and white thinker, doesn't see it that way. What he says is, quote, "I told the country that we did that, and I also told him it was legal. We had legal opinions that enabled us to do it." Well, you know, this is something that has to change somehow. What basically happened was Alberto Gonzalez was the White House counsel. John Ashcroft, an arch conservative, was the attorney general. And John Wu, tenured professor from Berkeley, who's back at Berkeley Law now, is in the White House, arch conservative, neocon type, writing opinions saying, you know, the Geneva Conventions don't apply to people we find on the battlefield that don't have uniforms on. And if terrorists are going to be trying to do terrible things to us, we don't have to treat them under any particular code. We don't have to treat them as the Geneva Convention says. They're enemy combatants. We can do what we want with them and whatever. Well, this is the rubber stamp the Bush administration was looking for, and they ran with it. But to now claim that, oh, it was legal because my Justice Department said so, you know, they didn't go. They didn't involve the State Department lawyers in this. They didn't involve the Pentagon military lawyers in this, both of whom would have said, no, 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 you got to put the brakes on. John Woo's out of his mind. This document won't stand up to scrutiny. Instead, they just ran with it. Didn't worry if it would stand up to scrutiny. And it didn't. 9 months later, it was rescinded, the first torture memo. More recently, another one has been rescinded. That is, it's inoperable, as they say. So I just think that it's weird that this news comes out over the weekend that President Bush, that torture got talked about at the highest levels of the government, and nobody makes much of it. What's interesting about that, of course, is that the claim has been made all along that Abu Ghraib, the scandal at Abu Ghraib and any torture that went on at Guantanamo was just a few bad apples. No, I suspected this all along. I've been saying I suspected it all along from the hints that were out there from the articles by Cy Hirsch and others that what was going on was a nod and a wink from on high, not explicit orders, but a nod and a wink saying, these people aren't really human. They're not like us. And the bottom line is the message was, you can do what you want with them. So enough on that issue. Let me just spend a couple minutes on Iraq. So General Petraeus and Ryan Crocker, the ambassador to Iraq, went in front of Congress last week and basically said, we need more time. The surge is working. We've made some gains, but we need more time. So we want to put a freeze on, keep troop levels where they are till the fall, and stay the course. We think we're turning the corner. We need 6 more months. All of that crap we've heard before. It's really amazing how far apart the two sides are in this. And by two sides, I mean the 55% to 60% of the country that wants us out and the 35% to 40% of the country that believes that we must stay till we win, and if we pull out, we lose. We've talked about that kind of rhetoric on here before and how black and white it is. Even McCain is falling into that rhetoric. But it's just really interesting that that's the state of the debate. You know, in the same way that we don't agree on the lessons of Vietnam, conservatives think that was, they still think that was a winnable war, and that mamby-pamby liberal protesters and the presidents didn't let the military win it, which means we didn't let them nuke North Korea. But there's a reason why we don't do that kind of stuff, all right? You lose your moral authority in the same way that all these troops in the Middle East are costing us our moral authority. Every time we get blamed for an episode, every time we blow up something by mistake and kill civilians, we get a black eye. War is hell, and you're going to get tarred by it if you're too close to it. So it shouldn't surprise us, and yet somehow it seems to. Anyway, the other thing that's interesting is Bush, Petraeus does his speech first, softens up Congress, and then Bush does a speech to the nation and says, okay, I'm going to take Petraeus' advice. Let's not forget how this whole thing started. The country wanted Bush to pull out. The 2006 election came, and the Democrats took over the House and Senate because the Bush administration was on the wrong course. Then we have the Iraq Study Group, which held its report till after the election, but basically the wise men of both parties said, and women, said, hey, you know, you don't have the country behind you. You need consensus. the consensus is to pull out, it's time to start withdrawing troops. As a caveat, as I've mentioned before, as a little bit of a sap, not a sap, a sop, maybe it was a sop to the five Republicans on the committee, actually not the Republicans on the committee, the Bush administration begged the Republicans to get inserted into it the concept of a surge, that maybe a short-term surge could be useful. They did, and then when the report came out with adults saying to George W. Bush, you got to pull out, he said, see this clause about the surge? That's where I'm going. And so we've now been surging for a year to a year and a half, right? But we've had, basically, Bush made a decision a while ago that he's not going to lose this war on his watch. That is, if there's going to be any pullout of troops, it's going to happen under the next president. And so the next president will pull out troops. There will be bloodshed afterwards. Iraq may become destabilized, because it will become destabilized whenever we pull out. And there's likely to be heavy bloodshed whenever we pull out. Even if we get 8 years of McCain and then we pull out, it's likely to be trouble. But the Bush can look back and say, I didn't waver, but the next guy did, and so he's to blame for losing the war. No, this war was lost the day we went in. Colin Powell knew it. Much of the country knew it. Bush was advised that way, and he couldn't bring himself to listen because he'd already had his mind made up. So we're going to leave here with the results of the surge. The number of troops there. We had 130 before the surge. We have 140 when the surge is over. Basically, Bush is staying the course for more than 2 years, and that's the power of the executive. The country can't seem to do anything about it. And on that depressing note, I'm going to leave you. We'll be back, though, on The Andy Finn Show next Monday night. And until then, you can go to my website and listen to podcasts of my previous show. You can sign up for my podcast at iTunes or any number of other podcasts. Just type in The Andy Finn Show or go to my website, andyfinn.us. And until next week, remember, do it. Don't doubt it.